Evolutionary Psychology, Part 1, The Science of Human Nature, Lecture 11, Monogamy and Polygamy.
We left off the previous lecture with the observation that true monogamy, in the lifelong version prescribed in most Western moral codes, is almost unknown among non-human animals. Which brings us back to the burning question which almost everybody wants to know the answer to. And the answer many people publicly dread and perhaps privately hope for. What are humans, monogamous or polygamous? An excellent question, and one for which we will have an unambiguous answer by the end of this lecture. However, before answering it, we need to ask and answer another question. How would one go about finding an answer to this question? And what exactly do we mean by humans? One way to answer both of these questions is to ask people what they're doing. This is generally the approach taken by social scientists, such as anthropologists and sociologists. Some social scientists sometimes try to get the answer to this question using somewhat indirect means, such as using census data or demographic statistics. However, both of these kinds of data also depend on people telling the truth about what they're doing. Now, this is a problem when it comes to sexual behavior, not only because there are strict codes of what kind of sexual behavior are right and wrong, but also because self-disclosure on questions like this can be used by other people to categorize the person answering the question. So, how to get an answer that doesn't necessarily depend on people being honest about the most intimate details of their private lives? One way is to use anthropological data collected by field anthropologists who've not only asked people what they're doing, but have also carefully observed what they are doing to see if it conforms to what they say they're doing. Data like this has been collected from many different cultures over the past century and has been published in the scientific literature. However, not all of it has been collected and analyzed for cross-cultural patterns such as the one we're interested in here. The largest cross-cultural database of anthropological information is the Human Relations Area Files, a huge cross-section of anthropological data established in 1949 and currently maintained at Yale University. According to the Human Relations Area Files, out of all the human cultures that have been studied, the percentages of socially acceptable or encouraged mating patterns are as follows. And here comes the answer to the question. Polygyny, which is one male with multiple female mates, comprises 83% of all independently described human cultures. These specifically include cultures and societies in which having more than one wife is either encouraged or at least socially allowed. A significant fraction, about 20%, of such societies practice sororal polygyny, in which a male mates with two or more sisters. Polygyny is, or was, until recently, common in most of sub-Saharan Africa, Southeast Asia, pre-colonial Australia, pre-Columbian North and South America, Polynesia and the other Pacific Islands, and most of the Middle East. Only a minority of males in such cultures were or are polygynous. Obviously, not everyone can, because the sex ratio in humans is essentially 1-to-1. But the degree of polygyny usually is directly correlated with socioeconomic status and political influence. In other words, the vast majority of all human cultures allow or even encourage polygyny, although even in those cultures that do so, only a small number of the men have more than one mate. Monogamy, that is, one male with one female mate, comprises only 16% of all independently described human cultures. These specifically include cultures and societies in which monogamy is either serial or lifelong, but in which multiple mates are not allowed or socially sanctioned. Monogamy has been common only in Europe and its colonies, that is, colonial and post-colonial North and South America and Australia, and parts of the Middle East, in particular, post-exilic Israel. The majority of males and females in these societies are monogamous, but there are significant frequencies of covert extraparacompulations. We'll talk about more of this in a minute. This means that given the definition of serial monogamy developed in the previous lecture, that is, that serial monogamy is actually vertical polygamy, only a small minority of human cultures are monogamous, and then not all of the members of those cultures actually practice it. In other words, only a small minority of all human cultures require all of their members to be monogamous, and even in those cultures that do so, not all individuals of either sex have only one mate, especially for life. Polyandry, which is one female with more than one male mate, comprises less than 1% of all known human cultures, and even then it is sometimes problematic to determine if the actual mating system is indeed polyandrous. Polyandrous cultures include societies in which having more than one husband is either encouraged or at least allowed under special circumstances. Interestingly, almost all known polyandrous societies practice fraternal polyandry, in which a female usually mates with two or more brothers. Polyandry is currently and apparently has been very rare among humans. The only documented polyandrous human cultures are in Himalayan Nepal and Tibet, and a few isolated social groups in southern India. Lewis Henry Morgan and Friedrich Engels, among others, suggested in the 19th century that polyandry was the most likely prehistoric mating pattern in humans. But this idea, which was most popular in the late 19th century, has not been supported by historical or anthropological evidence. What about polygynandry, which is more than one male mating with more than one female? Well, unfortunately, polygynandry is not a category formally recognized by the contributors to the Human Relations Area files. This is because no known human society formally recognizes group marriage as a legitimate or socially acceptable mating system. However, as most adults are aware, covert polygynandry is a phenomenon that has existed since prehistory. The question is not, do human females and males have multiple mates, but rather, how often and under what circumstances do human females and males have multiple mates? An obvious question, but not one that's easy to answer, because such behavior is almost always kept hidden, and hence its designation is covert. Several studies have been conducted, some of them inadvertently, into the frequency of extraparacopulation of humans in societies that are technically socially monogamous. Demographic studies have indicated that the frequency of covert female extraparacopulations that result in offspring ranges from less than 2% to greater than 55%, depending on locality, economics, and social group. The reason I emphasize covert female extraparacopulations is because these are really the only ones that we can capture demographically, especially on the basis of paternity records. Females have the babies, and therefore it's possible to correlate where those babies come from, especially now with things like DNA testing. In groups with what's known as high paternity confidence, the frequency of covert female extraparacopulations that result in offspring ranges from less than 1% among the Sephardic Kohanim to about 11% among Mexicans. In general, groups with high paternity confidence are from higher socioeconomic levels. In groups with low paternal confidence, the frequency of covert female extraparacopulations that result in offspring ranges from less than 15% among urban Russians to greater than 55% among Americans who have used medical clinics to determine paternity. In general, groups with low paternity confidence are from lower socioeconomic levels. Overall, taking a meta-analysis of these studies, the frequency of covert female extraparacopulations that result in offspring averages around 4%. While this number may seem low, consider that this means that in the United States alone, approximately 12 million people are not the genetic offspring of the person who thinks he is their father. Furthermore, since not all matings result in offspring, especially in societies like ours that sanction or practice birth control, these frequencies are therefore minimum estimates. The actual rates of covert extraparacopulations, regardless of whether offspring result, are clearly higher, probably much higher. The conclusion one comes to, after studying this data, is that a significant fraction of both female and male humans are polygamous. That said, it's important to point out that it is likely that females and males have different evolutionary reasons for favoring polygamy. Females are motivated to perform extraparacopulations because the offspring of such matings exhibit more genetic variation than the offspring of a single male. We've sometimes referred to this as don't put all your eggs in the same basket phenomenon. Increased genetic variation is positively selected in variable environments. This is especially true when the extra males with whom the females mate have heritable characteristics that increase the reproductive success of their offspring, especially the ability to get many females to mate with them. This often results in a phenomenon known as neophilia, that is, females tend to be positively attracted to males that look different from the males in their social groups. Females are also motivated to perform extraparacopulations because they may obtain resources from males who are not their mates. This is particularly the case when females can conceal the paternity of their offspring from their partners. Sillen, Tullberg, and Miller, in 1993, argued that concealed ovulation began as a female strategy to allow females to mate with several males and simultaneously avoid the danger of retributive infanticide. Once established, a female could choose a carrying male with good access to resources and used concealed ovulation to ensure his continued commitment. She could also seek matings with other males, confident that her partner would raise any subsequent offspring as his own. This may also explain why human females have permanently enlarged breasts, as it is then difficult for a male to assess when she has ceased lactating and is ovulating again, or even when she is in the early stages of pregnancy, perhaps with another partner. With males, it's a lot simpler. Males are motivated to perform extraparacopulations because doing so results in increased numbers of offspring, compared with a male who mates with only a single female. As mentioned in an earlier lecture, American mating patterns approximate what is often called serial monogamy. But what exactly do we mean by this term? A demographic study of human sexual behavior in America was carried out in the early 1990s, and the results published in 1994. Often referred to as the Sex in America study, it was the largest and most comprehensive study into mating behavior among Americans ever conducted. Although the authors claimed that their findings, which were primarily statistical, indicated that Americans are overwhelmingly monogamous, a clear and close examination of the data reveals just the opposite. If one considers serial monogamy as a socially acceptable form of vertical polygamy, then the following percentages of Americans are polygamous, according to the Sex in America study. Males who have mated with more than one female comprise 77% of all males. Females who have mated with more than one male comprise 65%. Americans, regardless of sex, who have mated with more than one person comprise 72% of the data. In other words, the most reliable demographic data, including census data, indicates that serial monogamy, in the form of serial divorce and remarriage, is now the statistical majority pattern of marriage in the United States and much of Western Europe, Japan, and other developed nations. Since the publication of the Sex in America study, more in-depth investigation has shown two continuing trends. The frequency and trends described are increasing both in America and worldwide. These frequencies are probably underestimates, especially for females. Recent studies in England, in which participants were essentially hoodwinked into thinking that they were taking a test in which lies could be detected, showed that females are more likely to underreport the number of sexual partners that they've had, whereas males consistently overestimate the number of sexual partners that they've had. Although no single cause for these trends has yet been identified, there are clear correlations with economic and historical forces and events. Dramatic increases in divorce rates in the 20th century have been correlated with wars, especially World War I, World War II, the Korean and Vietnam Wars, and the First Gulf War. The increase in divorce consistently follows the end of the war by between 6 months and 2 years. Increases in divorce rates in the 20th century have also been correlated with the institution of social welfare policies, especially those under which unmarried females are provided by the government with long-term child support indexed to the number of children. To an evolutionary biologist, the term serial monogamy is an oxymoron. As I tell my students, if it's cereal, it may be breakfast food, but it certainly isn't monogamy. From the standpoint of who mates with whom and who has children as a result, it makes no evolutionary difference whether one currently has several mates or has had several mates in series. The outcomes are the same: offspring with more than one mate. For this reason, it makes much more sense to call what Americans, Europeans, and others are doing vertical polygamy. Vertical meaning separated by time, visualized as a vertical axis, and polygamy meaning having more than one mate. Beginning in 1990 and ending in 1995, I performed a pilot study into the dimensions of vertical polygamy in the United States. The data collected were almost entirely derived from observations, with some data obtained from questionnaire and interview results. Subjects were chosen using random sampling techniques, and the data was collated and statistically analyzed. Unfortunately, difficulties in collecting the data meant that the sample size for this study were insufficient to draw conclusions that would be applicable to the United States population as a whole. However, the correlations I found were sufficiently strong to suggest the following. The rates of vertically polygamous mating generally agreed with those derived from the Sex in America study and other studies, indicating that the data that I had collected was reliable. Both females and males are vertically polygamous, although at slightly different rates. Males clearly divorce and remarry more often than females, another finding that's consistent with the other data from other studies. Males consistently remarry with younger females and have more children with each subsequent mate. Females generally remarry with older males and have fewer, frequently no children, with each subsequent mate. When compared with the data from polygamous Mormons in the 19th century in Utah, for which there are copious records, the reproductive rates of females and males approximate those of polygamous Mormons, although with lower overall numbers of offspring. Indeed, the degree of reproductive asymmetry, sometimes called reproductive skew, is even greater among 20th century Americans than among 19th century Mormons. In other words, American males today have a higher frequency of polygamy and the production of children as the result than Mormons in the 19th century. This is paradoxically because people have fewer children now than in the 19th century. Therefore, every child represents a larger percentage of the total today than in the 19th century. In other words, in the 19th century in Utah, a polygamous Mormon might have had 10 children, 8 of them with one wife and 2 with another. An American male from the late 20th century might have 3 children, 2 with one wife and 1 with another. On a per capita basis, the polygamous Mormon from the 19th century had essentially 20% of his extra children with a second mate, whereas the American from the late 20th century had 33% of his children from an extra mate. These results have the following evolutionary implications. Female and male Americans are both motivated toward polygamy, although at different rates and probably for different underlying evolutionary reasons. These mating patterns are correlated with the disintegration of the nuclear family, the relative impoverishment of women compared with men, and increased social pathology, especially in urban areas. In addition to the reproductive data outlined earlier, I was also able to draw some correlations between divorce rates and socioeconomic level. Again, these correlations are similar to those found in other studies and shed further light on the forces that are driving the immense demographic changes in divorce and remarriage in America and worldwide. The first and most obvious correlation is that the higher a man's socioeconomic level, as indicated by average annual salary, the more likely he is to divorce, to remarry, and to have children with his second and subsequent wives. Divorce and remarriage rates are also correlated with socioeconomic level in women, but significantly, the rate of having children with second and subsequent husbands is not. In other words, the more economic resources a man controls, the more likely he is to have multiple wives and increased relative numbers of children. This pattern is exactly the same as that for horizontal polygyny, as shown by multiple demographic studies of polygyny in West Africa, Polynesia, and other locations where polygyny is open and socially acceptable. These patterns can be observed directly by even a cursory examination of American culture and American history. For example, Ronald Reagan is notable in this regard as having been the first divorced and remarried man to have been elected president of the United States. Divorced and remarried men had run for president prior to Ronald Reagan, but their status as divorcees worked against them during elections. But by the time Ronald Reagan successfully ran for president, the social stigma against divorced men had almost completely disappeared. Wealthy and powerful men and women are also more likely to have had public extramarital affairs. This is not simply because their lives are more visible, but because there's an actually increased frequency of such behavior among the wealthy and powerful. Virtually every American is familiar with former President Bill Clinton's extramarital affair with White House intern Monica Lewinsky. Recent biographies of former presidents indicate that many of the presidents of the 20th century, from both political parties, had extramarital affairs, some of which were known by members of the press and the public at the time. For example, President John F. Kennedy is now known to have had multiple affairs with several women, including Marilyn Monroe. President Dwight Eisenhower is known to have had an affair with his driver, Kay Summersby. President Franklin Roosevelt had a long-term affair with his private secretary, Lucy Mercer, and President Warren Harding not only had at least one affair, he even fathered a child as a result. American presidents are not alone in their frequency of extramarital affairs, nor is this phenomenon restricted to liberals. Both Newt Gingrich and Rush Limbaugh have divorced and remarried multiple times. Indeed, divorce rates in the so-called red states are higher than in the blue states. And this isn't just an American phenomenon. The former president of France, François Mitterrand, publicly supported a mistress while president. His mistress attended President Mitterrand's state funeral in the company of her daughter and Mitterrand's wife. Billionaire financier Warren Buffett has had a ménage à trois with his wife and his private secretary for decades. And the extramarital affairs of golf star Tiger Woods are now famous, or infamous, depending on one's outlook. Many historical figures, including British Admiral Horatio Nelson, artist Pablo Picasso, composer Richard Wagner, philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, and poet Ezra Pound, are known to have had long-term ménage à trois relationships. And a theme of threesomes is widely used in advertising, fiction, movies, and television. Indeed, there is currently a hit series on HBO in which the main characters are the members of a Mormon plural marriage with one husband, Big Bill, and his three wives and their children. There is even a social movement, similar to the gay pride movement, whose supporters demonstrate publicly for the widespread acceptance of polygamous relationships. Because of the negative connotations of the term polygamy, these activists call their preferred form of multiple relationships polyamory. A quick search online demonstrates that not only is polyamory a widespread phenomenon, it is also a political movement that aligns itself with the movement for the recognition of gay marriage and the removal of government from private relationships. What can we conclude from all this? Well, the first thing is that polygamy isn't just ancient history or something that happens in primitive societies. It exists today, and there are many indications that it is increasing in both frequency and acceptance worldwide. As long as the economic and social conditions that have resulted in the current trend toward vertical polygamy, demographically characterized as divorce and remarriage, the polygamous mating patterns that I have described will also persist and almost certainly increase in frequency in the United States and the rest of Western culture. On the basis of this, I make the following predictions. The frequency of extra-pair copulations among Americans will continue to increase until it reaches some new equilibrium value, the parameters of which are yet undefined. As the trend predicted above intensifies, there will inevitably be increased political support for modifications to legal and social sanctions against polygamy, resulting in political efforts to legalize polygamy in one or more states within the next 10 years. Such proposals have already been made, but have so far been unsuccessful. If some form of polygamy is legalized in one or more states, polygamy in these locales will evolve in patterns similar to those in social monogamy. And in particular, economically and socially preeminent individuals of either sex will become positively identified with polygamy and a stable polygamous lifestyle. So far, we have seen that contrary to what most people profess or believe, monogamy is neither common nor currently stable among most humans in most human societies. On the contrary, over the past century, there has been a massive and pervasive shift in the common mating patterns of humans worldwide. Exactly what has triggered this shift is still a matter of some debate, but it is no longer debatable that such a shift has occurred. Essentially, something happened in the past century or two that caused human mating patterns to change fundamentally from what they had been in Europe, the United States, and the other developed countries, to the pattern that now exists. Although there have been blips in this change, for example, in the past year or two, there have been slight declines in the divorce rate nationwide, the overall trend has been relentlessly upwards. Clearly, this trend has to level off at some point. Where it will level off, we really have no way of knowing until it does. When it does, it will level off, however, unless it goes back down as strongly as it came up over the past century and a half. Where it will level off will be at some level in which the majority of people in virtually all human societies are polygamous, at least functionally polygamous. Societies, of course, don't currently sanction polygamy. They don't allow it for most people. This situation is clearly unstable. At some point, what I expect will happen is that formal polygamy will become increasingly accepted in societies that were previously formally socially monogamous. Those societies will look very different in some ways than the ones that we live in now. However, they will function actually fairly similarly to the ones that we live in now. How is it that people do all this, become attracted to multiple people and mate and have children and so forth? Evolutionary biology is all about sex and reproduction, and secondarily about things like death. In the next lecture, we will consider how it is that people are attracted to each other, how it is that they use this attraction as a way of identifying mates, of convincing those individuals that they wish to mate with them and wish them to reciprocate, and then actually get down to the business of copulating and making babies. So far, we have seen that sexual reproduction in mammals can be divided into three distinct stages: courtship and mating, attachment, and child rearing. The previous four lectures have been all about the evolutionary dynamics of mating. We began with a lecture on the evolutionary basis for female and male genders and their relationship to sexual reproduction. This was followed by three lectures on the evolution of mating systems, especially monogamy and polygamy, as predicted by Robert Trivor's theory of parental investment in sexual selection. We discovered that monogamy is the least likely mating system to have evolved and remained stable among mammals. The various types of polygamous mating, polygyny, polyandry, and polygynandry, make up the vast majority of the mating systems observed among the kingdom Animalia. Polygyny is especially common among mammals, including our closest relatives among the apes, chimpanzees, and gorillas. And we finished by pointing out that polygynandry appears to be the dominant mating system among humans, including Americans, although most people are unaware that this is, in fact, what they've been doing. However, we haven't actually discussed how it is that humans actually manage to mate with each other, how we pick out a likely candidate for a mate, how we court such a candidate, and how such courtship eventually leads to the underlying evolutionary focus of mating, that is, copulation and fertilization, and how these then translate into making babies and raising them up to become sexually mature adults. In the next lecture and the three that follow it, we will examine all of these processes from an evolutionary viewpoint. Once again, as we do so, keep in mind that all of these activities have both proximate and ultimate causes, that is, physiological causes and evolutionary causes. We will therefore often be considering the details of how we are attracted to each other and how that attraction gets translated into the elaborate behavioral dance that leads to fertilization. At the same time, we will constantly be referring back to the underlying evolutionary explanations for the existence of such behaviors. That is, how they ultimately result in increased relative reproductive success. In particular, we will use the ideas developed in the past few lectures to explain how natural and especially sexual selection has resulted in the kinds of mating and child-rearing behaviors that we observe among the members of our own and closely related species.
This ends Lecture 11.